Hi, this is Scott Kramer, and you're listening to A Dark Companion.
This is Zero, and you're listening to A Dark Companion, a Haunting Melissa and Dark Hearts podcast. Today, I've got another guest from the crew. Guest, why don't you introduce yourself?
Hi, this is Scott Kramer, and I'm happy to be here. I was the sound designer on the piece.
Yeah, I'm very happy to have you, especially because, you know, sound and everything is what I'm big into, and so this is a great opportunity to talk to you.
Excellent.
First thing that popped into my head when Neil mentioned you wanted to be on the show was to find out, because with both of these movies and them being, you know, completely based on apps, is what kind of new challenges did you run into with doing something like that versus, you know, other film projects that you've done?
A couple things, you know, in a theatrical mix for a movie, you have speakers in the surrounds, so it's easy to, you know, steer sounds into the surrounds to do a scare or to kind of immerse the viewer more in the story. But since we're an app, we're, you know, doing this for iPhone and iPad, so we had to figure out a way to make things interesting and almost make things seem to come from behind the listener or the viewer. And so that was one challenge. And then another thing was just the levels and figuring out how loud should we be, because we don't want to be like a really tacky, you know, reality TV show. Sure. That's so loud that it sounds about the same on everything, on an iPhone or a computer or a TV. Mm-hmm. But we don't want to be at a theatrical level where it's really, really quiet and you turn your iPhone up all the way, but it still isn't enough. You know, you've probably heard about people complaining that they're watching an old movie on TV, especially movies from like the 80s, and the loud stuff is too loud and the quiet stuff is too quiet.
Right.
So they're constantly... You've probably experienced this before, right?
Yeah, too much of the dynamic range is just completely out of whack.
Yeah, so dynamic range was a big concern, and so that was something that I wanted to kind of figure out. And so we found, you know, new ways to do things that I think we can use for other apps that we might do, or for you know, other people we might work with in the future.
Sure. Because I was thinking about it when, you know, when I'm doing stuff with my band or mixing sound, and, you know, I'm playing it in my car and I'm playing it on different sets of speakers, and so, you know, the situation where you're working with, okay, it's going to be an iPad speaker or an iPhone speaker or headphones, or maybe they'll AirPlay it to their TV. Was it difficult to find kind of a middle ground between all of those different ways people would listen to this?
Yeah, and this is an issue with TV too, is you don't want things... It's two things. You don't want it to sound... You don't want to mix and do your mix for the person listening in the worst way, like the person listening on a bad TV speaker, mm-hmm. On like the built-in TV set.
Right.
But you don't want to mix in such a way that it doesn't sound okay that way. So what we kind of decided was where we were hoping that people would at least wear headphones when they're watching it.
Sure.
So we mixed in headphones. I started the mix on some, you know, speakers, and then as the deeper we got into it, and once Neil was actually collaborating with me one-on-one, we used headphones to make sure that the experience was going to be, you know, the most powerful like that. And then what we found was that without the headphones plugged in, it still held up and it still sounded fine, you know, just through the iPad and iPhone speaker.
Yeah, it definitely sounds good. on everything I've listened, and I've made mention a lot with our little group that we have on Twitter talking about the movie all the time, is that there's a lot of value in watching the chapters, but also going back and watching things even with your eyes closed and listening to all of the sounds, because there's like a whole nother story just in the sounds themselves.
Yeah, and you know, I was really fortunate to work with Neil because I feel like he's the kind of guy that understands the power of sound from a lot of the work he's done on other projects. And so when we went into the first Honey Melissa, I already had someone who was on my side who was committed to getting me what I needed to do the best that I could, to do fantastic work that we would remember, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Neil says a lot, like, leave everything on the field, you know, do give it 100%. And that's one way that he's really been inspiring. And on Honey Melissa 2, I, again, had what I needed to do the best work and hire some really great people to work with me to kind of make sure that the quality was even better, that we took it a step further. Because with a story like this, you know, sound is, it is like, it's really crucial. And, we, a lot of what made moments impactful was what we were able to add to it with the sound. And, you know, having the resources to do it also allows you to spend some time, with like kind of an R&D phase and find stuff that works, find what doesn't work, and discover interesting sounds and new ways of doing things that, you know, you don't always have that luxury.
Well, I'm curious, what kind of setup were you working with there?
Like equipment-wise?
Yeah, I saw some like behind-the-scenes pictures, like pretty significant-looking workstation and everything, and I was just curious, you know, as somebody who kind of wants to get into that field, what are you using?
You know, it used to be that you couldn't do sound without like a Mac tower, a Mac Pro tower. But things have changed now. And, while video still requires like a ton of horsepower, audio has gotten easier and easier to do. So my setup, I want to have a system that I can take anywhere, and be completely up and running at another location, so that like if I decide to work from home one day, I can do that and not have to have like two different computers and sync up all my files and all that.
Right.
So I actually, my whole system runs on a MacBook Air.
Nice.
But the MacBook Air is connected to like this monster chain of all kinds of peripherals. So I have a Mac monitor, a Thunderbolt monitor. Neil had an extra iMac in the office, so I had that chained in for a second screen, so I didn't have to use my, I have kind of a cheaper LCD screen for a second screen. So we use two Mac monitors instead. Then I have a mix surface, because on a computer, you still need faders, you know, as I'm sure you know.
Yeah.
So, I have an MC, Euphonics MC Control and MC Mix, which gives me 12 faders as well as like a touch screen, and I can do EQ and that kind of thing. You know, treble, bass, all that sort of thing. I can do, compression. I can do like everything I need to just with that touch interface. So, it means that I'm clicking less on the screen.
Sure.
And doing things a little more, I guess you would say, kind of like a little bit of a more human touch on it.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense.
But that's not, I mean, that's just the outside stuff. Inside, there's, I had a RAID serving sound effects. I do the work in Pro Tools. And then there's this really fantastic program that I use for a lot of sound design called SoundMiner, which it's a combination of a database program that manages all my sound effects, because I have like, God, my sound effects library at this point is like 10 terabytes.
Oh, wow.
So the database program will allow you to instantly search it, and then you can also bring in plugins inside the database program to manipulate the audio so that it gets manipulated in the database program, and by the time it's even sent into Pro Tools, you've already done design on it.
Hmm.
So it just makes things, it makes it a lot faster and more efficient, and it gives you a lot more power to go through a huge sound effects library.
Man, oh, that's That sounds pretty impressive. I mean, and the quality definitely comes out in the work.
Thank you.
It's pretty amazing. And especially the way that you were able to kind of get sounds coming from every direction. And even though you're just working with, you know, headphones and, you know, stereo kind of field and not really going surround, being able to kind of manipulate in a binaural kind of way. To make those sounds coming everywhere.
It's similar to that. People could look up a concept called the head-related transfer functions, which is it's kind of a fancy $10 word for how the ears and how the brain interprets sound and how we interpret directional sound. And it's based on the phase relationships of the sound and when it arrives at each ear and that sort of thing. So we had some programs working, like some plugins working within Pro Tools and some other, you know, methods to kind of pan sounds beyond like the left right stereo field.
Mm. Yeah, because I've seen that's, you know, it's the way that for anyone that has no idea what we're talking about, how you know somebody's talking from behind you, or, you know, and even though you can't see them, there's your brain kind of interprets, you know, what it hits your ears at certain times, and also the kind of the quality of the sound. You can tell that. I've seen some, actually I was just looking at a thing today of a microphone that looks like a mannequin head.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then it's got microphones in the ears. And so you can get a really good representation of sound around you.
Yeah. Those are, they're one of those. I think there's a couple different models, but one of those like head shaped microphones, is really fantastic, and I have some friends that just used it on a new Antoine Fuqua movie about boxing that's coming out, and they went to a boxing match and recorded crowds that way.
Oh, wow.
And they said it really worked fantastic. They also had, you know, traditional microphones spaced apart all over the area, but they got some great sounds from one of those microphones.
Wow. Well, going way back, how did you kind of get started in this whole sound world?
Well, I thought I wanted to do music, and I was in, this is way back in like high school. I mean, it goes back even further. Like, I'm just one of those guys who kind of knew what I wanted the whole time. As young as like fourth, fifth grade, my parents gave me a stereo, and I would be like rewiring it all the time and trying to figure out different things to do. And then that gave way to like being a DJ for a while. But I realized I was more interested in like setting up a really impressive sound system than I was in like the music.
Oh, yeah.
So I was kind of like very technical at that point. And I was recording bands in high school and working in the high school theater. Just basically doing anything I could that involved sound. And fortunately, like doing sound for the events in high school meant you could also like get out of class at certain times.
Yeah.
So like that was cool. I got a lot of my friends out of class, and you know, we did sound for the events at school. I actually convinced the high school to buy a bunch of new fancy equipment that I kind of wanted to play with. And some of it they were still using a few years later. We had like a band night every year where we would have bands play at the school, and I ended up kind of producing that, and I would record it, mix the live sound, and rent some like subwoofers and some stuff like that. And then I applied to music schools, mostly to USC, Indiana University, Chico State, and Loyola Marymount. And then I think I got into all of them, but I ended up going to USC because I knew that I would have a better chance getting a job in LA. And I started as a recording major, I started working at a music studio as an engineer, and I realized pretty quickly that it wasn't, the industry was already affected by Napster and that kind of thing. And I kind of knew that it wouldn't be a great career. I could tell pretty quickly that, there'd be a lot of long hours, a lot of nights up all night in the studio, and it'd be hard to have like a family and that kind of thing.
Sure.
USC, of course, has a really great film school, which actually had a better studio than the music school had. They had this scoring stage called the Spielberg Scoring Stage. So I would record film scores for students there. And since none of the students in the film school wanted to do sound, or very few of them, most of them wanted to be directors or editors, or cinematographers or producers. So there was kind of like, it was either they wanted to do something a little more glamorous, or, you know, they were in crafts, but they were in, you know, visual crafts. So there was tons of opportunities to do sound, and really quickly I was doing sound for graduate students.
Wow.
And recording film scores for all kinds of different students. And then I had a mentor who was one of the teachers there, and he introduced me to some people, and that was how I got my first job.
Wow. Yeah. That's something I've been thinking about doing was like, there's a few colleges nearby, is kind of, approaching whoever's doing film there and see if I can, you know, try to put something together for them just to kind of get my foot in the door. Cause, you know, I have no idea how I would end up kind of getting into that world.
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah. It's changing really fast, and it gets, it feels like it gets more difficult every year. But it's still, you know, I wouldn't want to do anything else. Like, I love what I do, and it's really fantastic. And sometimes you meet some really great people, who are still committed to the art and still committed to making really good stuff. And that's where you kind of remember why you got into it in the first place.
Well, we got to your kind of origin there, but how did you end up getting in with Hook Digital Media and Neil? How did that first Haunting Melissa end up on your doorstep?
I was working at a studio called Wildfire Post in West Hollywood, and Neil and a producer friend of his named Darren Reed came by the studio, and we're looking at hiring a sound team for the first Haunting Melissa. And when I heard the concept and read the script, like, I was really like bowled over by the whole idea of making an app that was a movie experience. And we sat down with them, and I think my enthusiasm came through because they decided to go with us. And so we got to, it was basically through a studio.
Oh, wow. Is there anything that you might, I don't know, maybe think is interesting with some of the sounds that you had to create and just designing for this kind of film? I mean, maybe looking at some of the footage that's been shot, or just ideas you got from, you know, finding out the story and looking at the script and trying to put together an idea of a palette of sounds that you could use for this.
Yeah, I mean, it's important to come up with themes for the different characters and think about, you know, how much of a ghost is each character and how much are supernatural elements important? Is a character scary because they exist in the real world and they're scary and threatening physically, or is there something kind of supernatural to them? Are they kind of a ghost? And so we would talk about the different characters and get into, you know, how much of each of those things they were, and how much they exist in the real world. And that's a lot of where it started to come from. And sometimes, you know, people I was working with would surprise me. One thing that we did with the sound design is I would get different sound designers to give me ideas for each, you know, character or theme. And then I kind of look at them with Neil, and we talk about the pros and cons and how much it fit the character. And then we'd pick what we really liked and go with that, as like a theme for the film. So, you do hear a similar family of sounds for the different, for the lost lady, mm-hmm. for the, you know, the dark man, for the different characters, and they're going to be similar throughout the film, though they're going to change as the story changes.
Yeah, I was speaking of the other sound designers, and I guess also Foley work. I was looking at an article you were involved with for designingsound.org.
Yeah.
And you mentioned, for the footsteps, there was a footstep pass for, as it says, they're one of the supernatural characters, and, you know, layering the footstep pass and a movement pass and a ligament pass to kind of simulate an injury that a character had sustained.
Yeah.
I find it very interesting, like, taking all of those pieces that, you know, as the person listening, in the end, we don't really have an idea of what went into creating that sound, but it comes across in our heads anyway.
Yeah, and that's the idea with sound, is that it isn't something overt. And I think that good sound is something where you can see it and accept it, and it's affecting you, but you don't quite know how it's affecting you. And it doesn't stick out, and it's not distracting. But yeah, I mean, it's not, some people think that you just put up a microphone on the set and record what's there, and that's the sound. And it's not anything like that. Mm. It requires like a team of people to make it happen. And the Foley is actually, a friend of mine named Joe Karen, who's in, Canada, who is like immensely talented and sits there with his Foley Walker and him will sit there and watch the screen and perform the actions with props and shoes and actually walk the footsteps and use props to simulate, you know, different sounds that are needed.
Yeah, Foley is something I've been interested in since I was little. I saw something on TV and it showed them on the soundstage, you know, moving stuff around and creating those sounds. I was like, that seems like the greatest job in the world.
Yeah, and they're not, you know, a lot of Foley, there's Foley mixers and Foley artists, and the artists are the actual ones on the Foley stage in front of the microphone. And they're not technical people. They're a very different type of sound person. They're not, you know, into computers and that kind of thing. And they have this very active job. A lot of Foley artists have a background in dance. Because they're very physical and good at kind of manipulating their body to achieve, you know, different sounds. It's just, it's fun to meet them and work with them because they are a very different breed than a lot of people in sound.
Yeah. It's definitely something to be said for creating those kinds of sounds more organically versus, you know, taking some existing sounds you might have in your library and kind of manipulating them digitally to try to get something similar.
Yeah. Yeah. You can't fake footsteps and right. you can sometimes fake props, but it's not a good idea. On a lot of films, as budgets have been shrinking, people have been trying to edit Foley and they've been trying to edit footsteps and it just doesn't really work. There's something, that doesn't sound right about it. And I think it's because, we don't realize, but we're really tuned into the sounds that humans make. And so we know when something sounds real and when it doesn't. Whereas a car crash, can be played a number of different ways and still kind of ring true to the viewer.
Sure.
You can use, you know, different types of sound effects depending on how big you want to make it or how small. And everyone still knows that it's a car crash.
Right.
But human sounds are a lot different. Like, for example, punches are just this constant pain for sound guys because everyone has a different idea of what a punch should sound like on screen. Even when we haven't heard punches in real life.
Right, yeah. And you don't hear them maybe as cleanly as you would when you're watching it on a screen if you were to get punched or see somebody get punched.
And it's a very complicated relationship between, you know, the sounds that we expect to hear going into a movie based on other movies that we've seen and sounds from the real world and how they sound to us in our lives.
Yeah, definitely the human sounds because we hear them all the time. We don't consciously take note of them, but anyone, even someone who's not technical or not really involved in sound, can tell when something's just not quite right.
Yeah, yeah. It's kind of like the way bad visual effects, can be pretty obvious because it just doesn't feel real. Because our whole lives, have been trained to, look for certain cues and expect certain things, you know, in the real world. And when we see something on screen that doesn't look real, it doesn't look like the light is not right or the textures are not right. We know right away. And it's the same way with Foley and the same way with sound.
Did you have any like aha moments, or maybe even have to create something new for this kind of new way of doing film?
Well, in terms of the Haunting Melissa project, or?
Yeah, just, you know, getting into this new thing with an app and having to deal with, you know, things being over headphones or small speakers, and, you know, trying to make sure that you get the sound the way you want. Is there any, you know, thing kind of brand new that you had to do, or maybe something you haven't done normally?
The sound design itself is always a process of discovery, and if you're doing it right, then like almost everything you're doing is brand new. But as far as I think, as far as the technology of the Haunting Melissa goes, it was about the levels. It was about figuring out how to make things seem like they're coming from behind, and we did some things for that using like existing technologies, and we developed some other, things to make that all work. But the breakthroughs for me mostly happen when I get the right sound design, when it's dialed in and everybody's excited about it. And it just feels like we're bringing something completely new to the footage. Mm-hmm. We've turned it into something like way beyond what it was before.
Yeah. I was just thinking to myself about the sound in the menus, especially in Dark Hearts. And there's been, since the app came out, some little changes and new phrases and things like that, that have kind of popped up. What was it like? How do you kind of think about making that sound where it's kind of loose and ethereal and sounds are coming in and out, you know? What was your kind of thought process with that?
Well, Neil gave me some good direction on that, that we're kind of in a character's head and that it's this alternate universe. And so to do something that referenced the film and would give people this sense of like being lost. And, you know, for the sound of the like button pushes and that kind of thing, you're again dealing with like expectations. So what are people used to when it comes to an app, and how can you make it slightly different? And so for us, it's usually like using a little bit of distortion or a different tone than you normally expect, but having it still, you know, sound like a button push, a realistic app sound. You know, I think for me, the main thing was to make sure that all of the app sounds flowed naturally from the design of the sound for the film overall, for the piece, mm-hmm. and make sure that I was using sounds that were seen in the chapters or heard in the chapters. And so it's important to reference like the actual content when you're making the sound design for the app.
Yeah, it does have a very consistent feel, and yeah, the button presses and just the everything about it really feels like it gels with everything else, and it's consistent whether you're watching the film or you're just in the menus. Yeah, it all really, really locks together very well.
Yeah, and you know, it's because Neil is a craftsman and he wants things to be cohesive and to be authentic, and so everybody that was involved in the app is able to achieve that. We have what we need to make that happen. So I didn't think about limitations. There was no limitations. I didn't have to do everything really fast because we could push things out, you know, multiple times. I had plenty of time to get the concepts for the sound design right. And the most important thing, like I said, is that everybody is just really excited by it and scared.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. There's some good stabs in there and things that I also like the little kind of sounds that some of the DSCs, well, most of them have, was a little bit of a sound difference, something that happens that kind of lets you know it makes you just enough uncomfortable to realize you're seeing something off. Make sure your eyes dart around the screen to see what the heck's going on here.
Yeah, that was something. I mean, that's a new technology that Hooked does, and that required a kind of different way of thinking for sound design. And I did a whole new set of mixes for the DSEs.
Mm. How was it bringing in the score stuff from like Martin Tillman and stuff, like bringing that stuff in and figuring out where to place it in the scope of everything with the design sounds and the actual music?
You know, another way that this project was great is we had a joint spotting session. So I sat down with Martin and his composing partner, Jorg, and we watched it with Neil, and we talked about the different moments and who was going to hit that, because you don't want to have wall-to-wall loud sound and wall-to-wall loud music and then have to fight in the mix mm-hmm. for what's going to be the best. You want to pick the moments and be effective where you can really be effective. And Neil said from the very beginning that the best idea is going to win. But, you know, we discovered that there's some things that sound design can't do, and there's some things that it does really well. And one thing that the music was great about was the emotional core of the film and, you know, helping viewers feel the kind of loss and the loneliness of some of the moments. Whereas a sound design was often more effective for some of the fear and dread and scariness and, you know, immersing people in the story. So when it came to the mix, Martin and Jörg had really kind of picked their moments, and they'd written some great stuff, and it just kind of laid in pretty easily and pretty well. And there were situations where I would, you know, drop my backgrounds and my sounds way down to allow the score to really shine. And a few sections where we didn't use score, but really I don't remember that much of that. We were able to use almost all of it, and we didn't find that it was clashing. And I think that goes all the way back to the spotting session and really having everyone on the same page about the project.
Yeah, the moments where the score really stuck out were just super effective, especially a lot of the wide shots and, you know, going over landscapes and things like that. And whenever it hit, you really were impacted by, you know, this is, you know, you could tell, it was a different feeling than just, you know, this, a lot of the sound design stuff.
Yeah. I remember when we first got the music in, we were blown away and we were really pleased with what Martin and Jörg did. It was really like a next level kind of moment, because we didn't have music in the first one, or we didn't have much music. And so we felt like this was one way that we were really taking it to the next level. And we were really fortunate to work with them, because they brought it for sure.
Yeah, that score actually will be playing in the background of this podcast.
Oh, awesome.
Which I found to be really, really interesting, because there's so much space in a lot of mm-hmm. the parts of it, that it kind of pokes in. And there's been interesting moments on the podcast where, you know, some of that cello and stuff just pokes right in like a pause, and it seems almost perfect without even trying to line it up right.
Yeah, well, that's just a master film composer, which is what Martin is, you know.
Yeah, it's excellent. One sound in particular I've been curious about since the first Haunting Melissa, because I hate it and I love it, because it is super creepy. And I was curious if it was actual voice or what the deal was with that. But it's the kind of crying sound that they hear from that side bedroom in the first Haunting Melissa, kind of a moaning, crying
sound.
Oh,
yeah. I have a library of sounds of European sounds. And they're all written, the names of the sounds are another language. I've never put it into Google Translate, but I can't identify what a lot of them are. And this was an actual recording of a woman crying. And it sounds so real that it doesn't sound acted.
Right.
So when you use vocal recordings, this is kind of like going back to what we were talking about earlier. People can tell when something isn't authentic and when it doesn't have that sense of realness to it. And so often when people are asking for crowd sounds or human vocals, the smaller the crowd is and the more there's specific people, and if it's just one, it's really hard to do that, to fake that. It's really hard to do that without an actress,
right,
or an actor who's a professional who can make that, you know, believable and sell that. And, you know, as we know, there, even with actors, you know, people believe them to a different extent. But this is one of those recordings that I like stumbled on when I was trying to find a way to punch these moments up and make them, you know, take them to the next level. And I was like, this has to be, we have to put this in the project. This is a fantastic sound. So I used that. I did a lot of processing to it. I like a bundle of plugins called Sound Toys.
Yeah, which, I like those too.
Yeah, those are really, really fantastic. And I use those for sound design a lot. I think I had some of that on there, some reverb. It's important to make things sound as if they're in the room and to, you know, give it that sense of realism. A little bit of EQ and then a lot of level work. Like, I remember mixing that moment quite a lot, to just punch it up at the right moments.
Oh yeah. It's the creepiest thing ever, especially in the context of what you're seeing. And you just, cause you can tell it's real, but it's a little off and it's horrible, but it's great.
Yeah.
It's so effective.
Yeah. And I believe I did some pitch shifting to it too. It's just, and we've talked about it a lot since then as one of our favorite sounds from the first one. And, I'll never know where it came from, and I'll never know how real it was because I can't read the metadata that was included with the sound.
It's absolutely not something you'd ever want to hear in your own house.
No, no, that's for sure.
Time to sell the house and move. Well,
those kind of sounds are really gems, and you don't always share them with people, and you don't always let them out because you don't want to hear them anywhere else. You know,
oh, yeah.
You want them to just be in the one project that you intended them for.
Yeah. I kind of hoped that it wouldn't come back in Dark Hearts, and then it did. It was just creepy all over again. It makes your skin crawl. It's like, I really want to look at everything in the scene, but I don't want to hear that sound again.
Well, you know, because Dark Hearts was ours, and we wanted to reference things from Haunting Melissa 1 in Dark Hearts because we knew the fans would be paying attention and dissecting every moment. So we included a number of sounds from the first one.
Yeah, we definitely have it under a microscope, so that was a good callback, but it's hard to go through that again. I talked to Neil about this, and it's come up quite a bit. The creakiness of the doors in the Strogue house, how fortunate did it feel that you had just really just complete, because that's apparently how the doors sounded in there, this really great natural creakiness in that house.
Yeah, it was amazing. I didn't have to add. I remember adding door creaks to a few spots in the first Haunting Melissa. And there were a few times that I had to add them in this one, in Dark Hearts. But overall, most of the sounds for the door that you're hearing are from production, which is really rare because we replace just about everything.
Sure.
And though the house just sounded amazing. And I remember seeing some of the footage. The first time Neil sent me footage from Calgary, I think one of those door creaks was in there, and I was just like, oh my gosh, this is amazing.
Yeah.
We're lucky there to have Kelly Zombor as a production mixer who captured a lot of that stuff and even went into the house and recorded stuff for me separately. Mm-hmm. Just wild sounds when they weren't shooting.
Yeah.
I've never heard door creaks like that. I mean, they're amazing.
Yeah, and there's, I think it's chapter 12 where it's just full of them because she's going from like room to room and the doors are opening real slow and it's fantastic.
Yeah.
Did you at all get into the story? I'd be remiss if I didn't talk a little bit about the story and if you maybe had watched, you know, I know you definitely had to see stuff, but you know, did you kind of get into what it was all about and wondering the mysteries of Haunting Melissa?
Well, I think we've talked about some things behind the scenes that we don't want the mystery to stay.
Sure.
And we haven't talked about everything. And, I mean, I think I know, more than a lot of, you know, the viewers, because some of those things are meant to stay mysterious, sure. But I don't think I know the whole story. Mm. And so there, for me too, when I watch it and when I read the script, there's questions and there's a bit of, curiosity on my part too, is to try to figure out what is all this? How does it fit together? Yeah. And I think that's part of what makes it fun.
Yeah, it's absolutely, like, one of my favorite things about it is that you have a lot of questions and it's meant for there to be that much mystery and for you to look for things and try to find things and have unanswered questions in the end that you just keep going over and over and over again trying to figure them out.
Yeah, but I will say that, and I mean, The X-Files is one of my favorite shows, not yes. to disparage The X-Files, but unlike The X-Files, a lot of it is really well thought out in the overall conspiracy, and Neil has included a lot of references that actually draw back. There's something more to them. It's not all just loose ends.
Yeah, and to me, it seems pretty cool that you actually can play a part in that with the different kind of dialogue pieces that are used as little audio clips, especially in the menus. And you know, you hear somebody say something a certain way, and you wonder, okay, well, what do they mean by that? And so you get yeah. to kind of play with that kind of that mystery as well.
Yeah, and a lot of the vocal design was under a lot of direction from Neil, but as far as the processing, that was a lot me. But we had a lot of success with vocal sound design in Honey Melissa 1. And so we wanted to take that to the next level for this one. And that kind of goes beyond, a lot of what you see in the movies. Unless there's a specific creature in a movie that has, supernatural qualities, like a monster or like the trees in Lord of the Rings or something like that. Mm-hmm. You don't do a lot of treatments to the voice. You do the mix in a pretty straightforward way. But for Honey Melissa, I had a whole number of tracks in my Pro Tool session just devoted to vocal processing and making those voices, from some of the characters, really scary and even disembodied voices and things coming from out of, you know, left field that you're not even expecting to hear.
Yeah, Lost Lady, you can definitely hear there's, especially pretty wide in the stereo field, like the echo and delay of her voice, and it just really makes it huge.
Yeah, so there's a story there. We recorded ADR to Calgary and Toronto remotely. We were in our office in LA and had the actors in the studio up there in ADR studios, and we monitored the whole thing in LA, directed it. And it was an idea I had to multi-track the voice, because in ADR, when you're replacing dialogue, you typically do a number of takes. And I thought, what if we pick the better takes and then use more than one of them and put them in layers? It's kind of like, double tracking in music, mm-hmm. where you can add thickness to an instrument by recording it twice. And as I'm sure you know, like, it's important that they be like really perfectly in sync yeah. to pull this off, because otherwise it just sounds loose and you don't buy it. So, especially the actress that played the Lost Lady, did some really, really fantastic performances, but everybody did. And a lot of them matched right away. And other things, you know, sometimes I'd have to take one or two lines and really fine tune it to put them perfectly in sync. But I did that, and then I used some like stereo delays. I used some of those Soundtoys plugins, some reverb, a lot of stuff. And the thing I've discovered with pitch is that you have to be careful not to go too far with pitch, yeah. because it starts to sound cartoony or not like inhuman if you go too far with it. So sometimes I would take the double track, pan them, do one pitch slightly up and one pitch slightly down. But they'd also be going through a number of other processes.
One of my favorite characters, the Visitor, or Fedora the Explorer, as we call him, Tom Carey, he was on the podcast, and he actually did his intro for the podcast in character. including putting in the fake teeth that he said he used for doing the ADR.
Yeah.
What kind of processing or what was involved in creating that voice? Because, I mean, just him by himself with the teeth in was pretty dead on. So I was curious if there's anything else you did with it.
Yeah, I mean, all of their performances were really, really strong. His was extremely strong. I remember doing some panning with him because we wanted, especially when he's not on screen, we wanted to hear like the kind of rasp come from far away. So I did a lot more with reverb and space mm-hmm. on that one, and some panning. I did some double tracking in places and some different layers to it, and a little bit of pitch, I believe. So there was a lot going on there too.
Wow. Yeah. It's just really fascinating to look at this whole thing from both the film side and the audio side, and get an idea of what brings it together. Cause yeah, in a good scary thriller kind of a movie, sound is super important because it can affect all of your senses just like watching it. And I think you guys did an amazing job with that.
Thank you. It's really gratifying to hear that, you know, when people are excited about the sound. And it was with the first Honey Melissa, too, that people picked up on it and were talking about it really felt great for us. And it really felt great for me. It made me just so excited to get into the second one, you know, even beyond how ready I was for it already.
Mm. Excellent.
Because, you know, it's not every project as a sound guy where the sound is meant to be noticed or the sound can really improve the story that much. You know, sometimes in a comedy, you just want really straightforward sound. You know? Or you're using sound to comedic effect to kind of enhance the story that way. But that's about the extent of it. Sound can always affect people and it can always affect the story and help with storytelling. But in many cases, people don't notice it and they don't think of it as, oh, this is why I'm really being affected here, you know?
Yeah.
Because like I said, it's meant to be something that people can buy and not to take them out of the story. But when it can be flashy, like in, this genre or in action films or in musicals, it's like, it's really special just to get a little bit of a recognition for it. Cause so often we're just invisible in the background.
Yeah. I mean, I guess it's, you know, assumed like the music's in the sound is in the background and it's not as upfront as watching it. So I don't really have to think about it that much.
Yeah, and that's by design. You wouldn't believe the number of people that I tell them that I do sound for film and TV, and they say, so does that mean you put the music where it's supposed to be and, like, you do the music stuff? Or do you hold the microphone?
You're the guy with the boom, right? No, it's super crucial and just a complete home run on both films, and we're all absolutely looking forward to whatever happens next.
Awesome. Well, I'm sure there's more in store.
Yes. I'm going to keep bugging Neil until he tells me something. Gotta know. Well, Scott, thank you very much for coming on the show. It has absolutely been an honor to talk to you, both because of the film and also selfishly as somebody really big into sound.
It's been great to be here. Thanks for having me.
No problem.
I'm so excited that people are doing things like a podcast for it and that there's so much talk online about it.
Oh, yeah. I realized, you know, we're all talking, especially on Twitter, and it's like, let's get everybody involved. So the podcast came about, and so far it's been excellent. And the response from everybody has been great, and the support from the fans and Neil and for you for coming on the show. And this has been a great opportunity.
Awesome.
Well, Scott, any final words for the fans out there?
Just, you know, keep listening. We put a lot of work into it, and we're so excited that people are enjoying it. And it is one of the better experiences of my professional life to have been involved with Honey Melissa.
Wow. Excellent. Thank you again. So this has been A Dark Companion. You can follow our chapter-based episodes through itwantstogetout.tumblr.com. And there is a link there at the top if you want to submit anything you found, screenshots, or just questions that maybe you're hoping to get answered. The podcast you're listening to now can be listened to also on adarkcompanion.com through Podomatic. There is a PayPal link there if you feel the need to donate to help support the show. It is greatly appreciated. And you can email me and the show at adarkcompanion@icloud.com. And you can follow the show on Twitter at A Dark Companion, as well as me at A Public Witness. So thank you for listening. And Scott, thank you for being on the show.
Thank you very much.